The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, The Psychology of Terror, was recorded at King's Place in May 2015 and was chaired by writer-reporter Tazeen Ahmed.
Hello and welcome to The Psychology of Terror at the Guardian Live events. I'm Tazeen Ahmed. I'm a reporter and writer, generally, and over the past 20 years I've covered a lot of stories about radicalisation, about extremism and about terrorism from a lot of different angles. And I've noticed that all the reporting, including my own, often simply just states the facts. He was an ordinary kid, he was obsessed with football, he went to the mosque on Friday, he was quiet, he came from a nice family. Sometimes we may learn there were financial problems or that he got into trouble with the police. Other times we learn that he developed some worrying views along the way. But we never get to know more about what was going on in this young person's inner life. And as a journalist and a student of psychotherapy and psychology, I think we need to know much more, have a much more well-rounded insight into what's going on for these kids. More than the facts, more than the timeline, the what and the how, we need to know why. So earlier this year, I approached The Guardian and said, let's do something on understanding, you know, the mindset of these kids, not from a sociological point of view, not from a political point of view, oh, not just from those points of view, and also not just from an ideological point of view, but also what's happening inside the minds and hearts of these young people, and that we ought to find out much more about what the war and terror generation are before, as, and during the process of radicalization. So 48% of British Muslims are under the age of 25. We know that at least 500 British Muslims have traveled to join ISIS. How do we stop others? Over the next hour with my extraordinary panel, we will explore what's motivating those born and bred in the UK to travel to foreign lands in the name of a brutal ideology, and what can be done to deal with this. So let me introduce you to my panel. Rashad Ali is the director of the Counter-Extremism Consultancy Centre and fellow at the Institute of Strategic Dialogue. Majid Nawaz is the chairman of the Quilliam Foundation, both are former members of Islamist groups. Abdul Bari Atwan, Palestinian author, journalist, and founder of the newspaper Raya Al-Yum, author of The Islamic State, The Digital Caliphate. Nazir Afzal, former chief crown prosecutor, who has made his name successfully prosecuting hundreds, thousands of grooming gangs, and he's now turning his hand to radicalization. And Rob Leach, award-winning documentary maker, who's made films about his stepbrother, My Brother the Islamist, My Brother the Terrorist. So you will hopefully give us an insight into what's going on in the minds of converts. Thank you all very much for being here. Majid, if I can start with you. If that young wannabe jihadi, just on the brink of radicalization, was to turn up in a therapist's office and sit themselves down, What would they say about what's going on in their personal lives, in their family lives, what happened in their childhood? What's really going on for them?
So, thank you. And I'll start by saying that my own experiences that I will address in response to your question shouldn't be taken to be, let's say, a rule of thumb that we can blanketly, in a kind of uniform way, apply to everyone. Because actually part of the problem is that people try and extrapolate and then make general rules and apply them in all cases. And actually the truth is there's no one path into radicalization and there's no one path out. But there are lessons, certainly, that can be learned. And with that, I'll talk about myself, because that's probably what I'm best positioned to do. I joined Hizb ut-Tahrir at 16. And just to very quickly say that that's an organization that was founded in 1953 and sits, in terms of the radicalization trajectory, it sits between the political Islamists who try and get into power through elections and democracy, and after them, the jihadists who try and use violence. Hizb ut-Tahrir is more of a revolutionary group that seeks power through military coups, but doesn't target civilians. I joined that group at 16, and what was going on in my life at the time both domestically and abroad, were very relevant. I felt very, very alienated from the society around me in Essex, where I was born and raised, because I had been targeted on multiple occasions by neo-Nazi skinheads who engaged in what they called paki bashing. This is the year before the murder of Stephen Lawrence, when racism was a real huge problem across the country. And people often forget that, because relative to those days, we are in a better position with race relations. There's a lot more to do, but we are relatively better off than we used to be in those days. And what happened to Stephen Lawrence and the way he was killed on the street is what these people tried to do to me and my friends on many occasions. And I'm lucky I'm alive. On one occasion, they isolated the white friend I had. I was 15 at the time, I must have been. I recall the story in my book, and they punished him for being my friend, and they forced me to watch as they stabbed him on multiple occasions all over his body and went at him with hammers and machetes, and they called him a paki lover. So this is a form of psychological torture, and as a 15-year-old, I look back now, and obviously we have the benefit of hindsight, I must have been very traumatized by all of that. And I wasn't able to speak to my family about it. You know, my mother's response was the response that one expects from the generation above us, who had come here for a better life and for a peaceful life. And their response was turn the other cheek. We're guests in this country. We're here to work and make earn a living, whereas we didn't feel like guests because we were born here. And the second thing to conclude was what was going on across Europe in Bosnia with the Bosnia genocide. And it was happening at the same time. And the interesting thing is that until Bosnia, I'd associated a lot of this with race. But then, of course, in Bosnia, we had blonde-haired, blue-eyed white Muslims who were being targeted ostensibly simply because they were Muslim. And into that mix came a recruiter from Hizb ut-Tahrir who was able to say to me, you think this is just about skin color, but actually, Muslims aren't welcome in Europe. Look at the Bosnians. And that really did have that impact. I'm not saying these are causes. I'm not saying that everyone is going to go through that experience. What I'm saying is they are factors that are relevant when discussing radicalization.
And you had somewhere then to focus the stress that you had experienced as a result of the trauma. Rashad, what is the gaping emotional hole in these young people's lives?
I think it is, like Majid said, it's very different for different people. And with some of the cases that we've looked at, I think the key thing that comes out, if you like, is this generational gap. There seems to be a distance between the older generation and the younger generation of British Muslims that are growing up in the UK. And there is a generational kind of break, if you like. The net result of that is it causes, I guess, issues pertaining to identity, belonging, which are easily exploited. I mean, when looking at some of the cases that we have in, you know, across London, some of these places, they're actually majority Muslim areas. It's actually almost the opposite of, you know, the situation where you have a minority group which is persecuted. They're majority Muslim areas and communities. But they still feel detached from wider society. They feel detached from the previous generation. So there is that detachment there that can be exploited. On top of that, I guess a lot of these things are, it's very difficult to pinpoint down, but you know, I was speaking to one young girl who described the Islamic State in Iraq, the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, as an Islamic Disneyland. This is a 16-year-old kid who tried to leave to go over and fly over to Turkey, and she was stopped. But this is the kind of... It's shocking to think of this kind of the childhood mindset.
So a form of escapism?
There's an aspect of escapism. There's an aspect of very strange, distorted rebellion. That actually is very strange, distorted rebellion from all the previous kind of... from the parents' generation, from the wider society. It's a strange kind of reaction to that.
Yeah. Rob, your stepbrother turned to extremism. What was drawing a white middle-class kid to this ideology?
Well, I think for Richard, and again, you know, there's hundreds of reasons why somebody might become radicalized or be drawn towards extremism. For my brother, I think it was just a sense of feeling like he didn't really fit in. If I were to go right back to a defining moment in his life, I would probably say it was something as simple as, you know, divorce, you know, not having a father figure around when he was growing up, which left him with this kind of desire to kind of find out where he fitted in, to find meaning and purpose in life.
Could you explain who your brother is for those who don't know?
Yeah, my brother is he's my stepbrother. He's Richard Dart. So he was he converted to Islam 2000, an extreme brand of Islam in 2009 under a guy called Anjum Chowdhury. I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And I made a documentary about him after his conversion, just sort of trying to sort of understand what he'd become a part of. And then later on, he was actually convicted of, pleaded guilty to terrorism charges, whereon I went and made another film, which tried to kind of understand why and how that could have happened, not just for him, but on a sort of broader level as well.
For him, it was divorce. Do you think that divorce made it?
No, it wasn't just divorce. I mean, divorce was the moment, the furthest moment I can go back where I can say that was a thing which led him on that path, of kind of being a kid who was insecure. Searching validation from people, and maybe not getting it, not feeling valuable.
How old was he?
He would have been, 5 or 6, so quite young. Mm. But then, obviously, as he grew up into a teenager, he had a difficult relationship with his father, and so it was this kind of, in the same way that I think a lot of first, second generation Muslims and Muslims today as well in this country have this kind of crisis of identity, trying to figure out, where they stand and who they are. I think that can also happen for a white British guy as well. Mm. He went on this journey to try and figure out who he was, and I think he maybe resented his past society a little bit because he felt like it dealt him a rough hand, and then someone comes along and gives you the answers and says, that world that you're from, they're wrong anyway, and you're actually now you're a Muslim, and this is what Muslims do, and that makes you better than everybody else. So that offered him a sense of validity and empowerment, but at the same time, it gave him meaning. And I think another thing that extremism offers, not just Islamic extremism, any form of extremism, is it offers you a black and white kind of view of the world. So it makes things less complicated. Mm. Growing up in Western society can be a very confusing, complicated experience.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more in a second, but sure. Let me just bring Nazir in. So that identity crisis is obviously the hallmark of all teenagers' lives.
Absolutely.
In what way is this impacting in terms of the family lives of British Muslims?
Well, a couple of things. Firstly, I've prosecuted lots of people for terrorist offences. I'm the man responsible for prosecuting the Danish cartoon protesters in 2006, charging them for soliciting murder rather than public order. They got 6 years rather than 6 months. But none of them ever told me why they were doing what they were doing. So it's difficult to get anything from the people that have been convicted of these offences. And again, the worry and danger of cause and effect, what Majid said, 60s and 70s racism was worse than 80s and 90s racism. And I remember being beaten up enough times, I became chief prosecutor rather than becoming a terrorist. So, there is a very distinct difference. I think I've spoken in the last few months, I've been talking to women's groups, and it's a shame there are no women here this evening, apart from you, Tazeen. And they tell me, because they're working with young people for all sorts of reasons, and part of the reason, they do talk to people who are having the conflicts that we've just talked about. And there are a number of reasons they give. One is the thrill seekers. You said Disneyland. Some of them thought park was never enough. And they want something that they can't get in this country. Some of them are seeking redemption. They've sinned, or maybe something's happened to them, and they want some kind of redemption. Some of them are are on an ego trip. You know, they feel special, and they'll be more special if they're doing something of this nature. And some of them have a grievance, and the grievance is maybe Gaza or some other part of the world. And of course, there is a charismatic individual of some kind, who, some have been mentioned already, who might be influencing in some way. But we've got to remember, we're talking about children. Children are children. You know, adults have all sorts of complexities which might direct them in a certain way, but children are easily led. And they're manipulated, and very easily manipulated. Well, yeah, what I've learned from tackling grooming offences is that this is grooming for ideology rather than grooming for sex. And you are, children can be easily manipulated. Absolutely, Rob, about the communication issues. The communication within family is now probably the worst it's ever been. That's my experience. That's the experience of women groups, particularly working in this field. And if they've got nobody to talk to, and somebody comes along and says, I know you're unwanted, I know you're unloved, you know, I want you and I love you, and then manipulates them in all manner.
And is there also, Abdelbari, something really attractive about the higher purpose, the bigger purpose, when you're a teenager?
Actually, first, I believe the background is extremely important. The background of many people in this country are, you know, Muslim background. You know, in Islam, we are different. We have something called karama, dignity. This is extremely important in our culture, in our tradition, as a Muslim or as a Middle Eastern people. You cannot just delete your past, your background, simply because you are living in London, even if you are the third generation. What influenced most of the young people in our community, even in you know, non-Muslim community? What happened in Iraq, for example, when there are, you know, hundreds of people were massacred by the bombardment of 15, of 16, B-52, definitely you will be influenced and you will be affected. If you are a Palestinian, for example, living under the West and under the Israeli occupation in the West Bank, and you are not allowed to actually use the same bus like the Jewish settlers in the West Bank, or, for example, if you are a football player, young, 14 years of age or 15 years of age, or 18 years of age, deprived of everything, you have your good feats, you manage to actually dream of a career or to be a star, and suddenly you are selected for the national team and you are not allowed to go and join the national team because you are banned by the Israelis. So, and there are a lot of examples like this. For example, in Syria, what is happening now in Syria, a lot of bombardment, whether by the regime or by the opposition, and the massacres, a barrel of dynamite. So this background is extremely essential. It does radicalize the people, especially in these countries. We have to remember that Britain was a member of the coalition which attacked Iraq, which attacked Afghanistan, or maybe partly Pakistan, whatever. So this is, you know, we have to look at these backgrounds.
Yeah,
and I can see the young people, how they are really radicalized. Why they're radicalized? They are not radicalized by school or mosque now. They are radicalized by the social media. It is there, you know, I am watching, I have a son 14 years of age. I am watching him all the time and see what he is watching, what he is actually
searching. Yes, and witnessing brutality and experiencing brutality means that they're signing up to a brutal ideology. But can I just ask you a little bit about the profile of these jihadis? Because we've now seen over the last year, girls come through the ranks, haven't we? So what's going on? Male, female, black, white? Is anybody vulnerable now?
Sure, I think in normally the stats, what they tend to show is that actually with women or girls, it's actually a very, very small percentage that actually do get involved. I think what we're seeing now with the situation with ISIS is
actually...
It's about
70 or 80, isn't it?
Well, this is the difference now with ISIS. It's actually about 5 or 6 times the regular rate. So we're talking about 20% of the people on average that have gone over have been women than girls. And also the other point that Nazir mentioned, I think is really, really fundamental. These are young kids. These are 14, 15, 16-year-olds. And so they are actually groomed, particularly with the young girls, because what we're seeing with the young girls is there's an older predatorial individual who literally finds them online, takes them offline in the sense of off public media, often speaks to them on Skype, as an example, grooms them very particularly with, hold on a second, your parents, they're not true Muslims. They don't hold on to Islam in the sound way, so therefore they don't look after your interests. Only we're here to look after your interests. you hold on to Islam in the sound way, and therefore you need to migrate. And then with the young girls, there's this added element that, hold on a second, you're going to be loved, you're going to get married. And the scene is, it is called marriage. And, you know, though it's a 15-year-old
girl. But why would these young girls, and we know about the Helaini twins, for instance, who were, you know, it's been said over and over again, 28 GCSEs between the two of them. They had aspirations to be doctors. One of the other young girls was a wannabe dentist. Why would girls with a bright future here in this country be drawn to a war in a different country where the life that they are signing up to is actually just to be... I mean, aren't they aware that...
No, I think that's
that
a really
what,
good...
What they are signing up to is actually rape.
I think they actually are aware of this. With many of them, they actually are aware of this when we speak to them. And there's a number of things to bear in mind. I think there's an assumption that if you're intelligent, somehow you would reject this type of thinking. And I think that's one of these assumptions. We almost forget our history. We forget that if you go back, you know, 2-3 decades, people were, what were they getting involved in? They were getting involved with things like, you know, and we're here at The Guardian, they're getting involved with things like communism, they're getting involved with things like extreme forms of socialism. And there was these ideological... Sorry about that. But essentially, they were getting involved with particular ideological persuasions which were founded by a certain set of ideas. And with some of the young girls that we see, exceptionally intelligent, got a very, very thorough grasp of all of the atrocities that are happening by the Assad regime, as mentioned. And they see, and they have an affinity. They have a connection, part of that Islamic identity. There is an additional layer of identity that connects them. I'm not saying that if you're, you know, I think all humans would care because there's 300,000 people being killed, 500,000 have disappeared, 11 million have been displaced. You know, it's the horror of our times. Mm. But I think there is an additional affinity because of their Islam. So I think that is done. But the one thing that's really, really important, it isn't merely the grievance that leads to this. Because if you look at what's happening now in Yarmouk, Yarmouk is in Syria, it's a Palestinian refugee camp. And it's a Palestinian refugee camp in Syria, which ISIS have taken over. And now here you're having ISIS people who are going there, beheading individuals, killing individuals, enforcing their version of what they see of Sharia upon the very Palestinians who they see, who allegedly they're connected to because of their grievance and their oppression. So we have to step back and understand, actually, it isn't merely grievance. There's a very, very strong, deep-rooted religio-political ideology, which then turns their whole morality around. Mm. So they go from being people, you can probably relate to a lot of this, it goes from being people who you normally, you can get on with, you probably go out, have a drink with, etc., to suddenly now, and one of the striking things in your documentary, I think we spoke about before, is not refusing to shake hands. Mm. You know, it's like, what, with yourself, and it's like, wow, that's a huge, complete turnaround of behaviour.
Okay.
And that's inexplicable without the psychological component
just,
of the ideology.
Just sticking to understanding the profile of these young people, is there a difference between the person who is prepared to, you know, do a beheading, a difference between the person on the front line, the jihadi bride, the thinker, the person who's the spin doctor of ISIS?
Right, so I want to just endorse the last point that Rash made, and also what Nazira said, that, you know, which is why I said these aren't causes, but they're factors, because it's very important for us to understand, which leads to your question, actually, that there are multiple paths in, and there isn't one narrative, and in particular, there isn't only the grievance narrative. It's really crucial to understand that Rob's brother wasn't an Arab who were worried about Palestine. Of course, you do, because you're Palestinian, definitely Arab.
Yes, yeah.
So everyone has different things that motivate them, and that, coming to your question, is that what we learned from Nazism is the banality of evil, is one of the conclusions we learned from it, that actually, when something becomes a zeitgeist, when it becomes the latest form of resistance, and it's out there as it was out there in the past for the Che Guevara generation, who, let's not forget, was a doctor, who left Argentina, went and fought in Cuba for a successful revolution, ended up dying in Bolivia. He had no connection to Bolivia or Cuba, apart from his sense of solidarity for that cause. So, and this man was a doctor, he wasn't a dumb, you know, he's a smart guy, he was educated. Not that people that aren't doctors aren't, but, you know, he's not, you know, the guy had a capacity to think. So, yes, I think that when something reaches that stage of becoming a zeitgeist, then there isn't one profile of somebody that can join. And smart people join, people that haven't studied, and people who are highly educated join these movements, and it can be anyone. And that's that if there's one conclusion from the statistics and the profiles that we've seen and have been studying for, in my case, 8 years, like Rash, and looking at these in the long term, if there's one thing that we can say is that the worst thing to do would be to try and profile these people based on male or female gender or racial appearance. If we start at airports, and I opposed, even under the last Labour government, I opposed all the efforts to try and introduce profiling for this very reason. Because if we say, as was bandied about at the time, that we're looking for young 20 to 30 Middle Eastern-looking men, then jihadists will simply go and recruit white Chechen black widow females, the sort of group that was responsible for the Moscow theatre attack. And they will walk in through with jeans and T-shirts, and they'll walk straight through because we're not looking for them.
And actually, what we've seen quite a lot of is that sort of young white men, good-looking young white men, have turned into the poster boys for ISIS.
That's right.
There have been videos that have gone viral.
Do you think I have to talk about girls again? Because you mentioned, and I think we made an assumption, because they're A-grade students, that they will finish their education, that they'll be able to have their careers. And going back to what we said earlier on about the communication aspects and the fact that parents and children aren't talking as they used to talk, particularly South Asian girls, that assumption doesn't become reality. They finish their education, if they're lucky. Generally, they will be married off to a first cousin or a second cousin. That's not going to be their choice, but they'll have to do that because that's traditionally what happens in those families. Even if the fathers and mothers say that's not going to happen to you, they don't believe it. Somebody else comes along online or whatever and says, I've got something better for you. I know your life is, your aspirations will not be met, your ambitions will not be achieved. And they believe that because they hear all these other stories of young girls who aren't able to achieve their ambitions in this country. And so,
but how is being married to a fighter a more attractive option?
Because it's like...
So how many women fancied Bin Laden?
How many?
Well, it's absolutely, these cowboys who present themselves in the propaganda and
I mean, it is very common, actually, in terms of with the young girls that we've worked with, it is very common that they aspire towards a marriage. It's how they see it. They will literally describe which of the guys that they're attracted to. You know, the Dutch ex-military chap was specifically a guy that many of the girls in the UK actually aspired towards going and marrying. And so that it is there, it's one of the motivations, amongst all the other things that were mentioned here, actually, that there is an opportunistic motivation. There are those that are religiously motivated, there are those... And I guess probably a good book that I'd recommend to everybody here is ISIS Inside the Army of Terror by Michael Weiss and Hassan Hassan. And it really explores both the different motives that young people have for going out there. Because you have got the thrill seekers, the guys who ride around in tanks and spin them around as though they're playing Call of Duty or some other computer game. Well, and also the guys who are firm ideologues. And we saw Abu Rumaysa write what was described as almost like a, what are the travel guides called? I'm really...
Tourist guide to the Islamic State.
Where it was, you know, the atmosphere is great, the food's okay, and et cetera, et cetera. And, oh, by the way, don't think we're ending here. We're going to come for Germany, America, and Britain and fight jihad and spill your blood. But the last few lines is kind of surreal. But that's obviously someone who's ideologically inclined and he's politically inclined and he's got that perspective.
And then there are the genuinely devout as well. I mean, I was in prison with a whole bunch of them. And they ranged from people that joined because they were hungry and they wanted food all the way through to the ideologues and the opportunists and thrill seekers to those who genuinely believed their religion calls for this type of action.
Mm. Oh, with the young girls as well. I mean, they firmly believe they are obliged. They believe there's a religious duty, a wajib, to go and make hijrah, to emigrate. You know, had these great historic emigrations when Pakistan was created. You had all the, you know, massive millions of people emigrate from India across to Pakistan. They believe in the same thing. But here you have the creation of the real Islamic government, real Islamic state, where they need to, they're obliged to go and live and help and support.
Do ISIS strike you as being much more, or particularly media savvy, that they really know how to exploit the online world and they're using that to best effect with young people?
I think almost certainly.
Can I get somebody else?
Yeah, sure.
Abdel?
You know, let me go back to how the girls are attracted. Let me say one important thing. In 2001, when we wake up and saw the 11th of September atrocities and the World Trade Center, I was in the media all the time, and you know, Osama bin Laden was voted, and this was published in the Daily Telegraph, he was voted the sexiest man in the world by British women.
Yeah.
Americans. Why? You know, we have to remember those young fighters, jihadists, they are good-looking people.
Not all of them.
Seriously, seriously.
Not all of them.
No, no, you don't know. I met them. You know, when I researched my book, no, they are very good-looking men. So whether we like it or not. Yeah, some women, they love beers, you know.
Can we quote you on that?
Sorry?
I'm going to tweet you, quote you on that on my Twitter.
No, they are. You know, look at them. You know, we are objective.
So you're saying that they're basically Prince Charming, aren't they?
Sorry?
They're Prince Charming.
I'm saying some women found them very attractive. You know, I remember when we were teenagers, we used to love the pictures of Steve McQueen with his gun in his backs like that. So why can't we just admit that those people are, regardless, we do agree with them, they are terrorists. But, you know, some of them are very, really attractive to certain types of women.
But, you I've got to say, having been a teenage female, I just can't see. I just can't see how that would be what they'd be signing up for exclusively. There must be something else going wrong in their lives.
It's not just that. It's important to recognise we can't generalise.
So then what else is going on? Because it's not just that, is it? Because otherwise they'd all, why don't they all run away to Hollywood?
Yeah, well.
No, they have their own Hollywood now. You know, in my book,
Disneyland,
you know, the digital caliphate, when I said Islamic State, the digital caliphate, I dedicated a full chapter about the media arms of Islamic State. They are very, very sophisticated. Go and look at their...
Well, can we talk about that? This is the thing. Talk about that? Because are they much more sophisticated than any other Islamic group have been thus far? And also, my sense is that they've got a really strong, good set of, like, Alistair Campbells behind the scene, haven't they?
No, but there's a reason for that, because actually they are... Well, they do. Yes, yeah, so Deso Dog, the German rapper... who was very well kind of understanding the kind of nature of rap videos and production quality, is one of the key guys behind there. They say he's their Goebbels, kind of one of the key guys behind their videos. But there's a reason for that. It's not because they have this X factor that no one else had. They are more modern than the others. They are of another generation. They are born of digital natives, which Bin Laden wasn't. I mean, look, consider his age. He was around before the time even mobile phones existed. So for him, a mobile phone as a technology is something that he has to learn and adapt to. For the generation that are joining ISIS, when we say digital natives, they've been born of the generation for whom the internet is, as Diet Coke is for me. You know, it's always been around.
You've definitely been sponsored tonight.
I know, the product placement. That's the main reason. That they are at home with social media as the average everyday 13-year-old teenage girl is, because they've been born through that. And then what they've done is they've recognized, because they're digital natives, something that's intuitive to them isn't intuitive to the 70-year-old. They've recognized the way to connect with others through this media. Everyone else is playing catch-up, because the people running policy and governments are of a generation that I still remember before mobile phones.
So how do we counter that? I mean, how on earth do you counter the fact that they know how to use social media in the way that nobody else has done?
I mean, last night,
and that they are actually recruiting en masse, aren't they?
I mean, last night I was in Glasgow, and there were 300 Muslim children, and the chief constable of Police Scotland was there, and lots of the young people were saying to him, "Just put locks on all the on the particular websites, close them down. It's impossible.
Yeah, you can't.
You know, it is. They grow. And so the young people were asking for that. They were saying, you know, in effect, this is an addiction, take the drugs away, you know. And the police were saying, as any authority will say, that we are playing catch-up. And so that isn't the answer. And of course, there will be people probably in this room saying, well, we shouldn't, it's freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera. We shouldn't be, you know, closing down portals anyway. But in any event, we can't physically.
Yeah.
And they always find the means and technology to do that. So it's not about how the message gets through. It's what the message is.
There's 90,000 people on Twitter who are retweeting ISIS material, and the Met closes down like 1,000 every day. So you're never going to really be able to keep up with that. And the other aspect is the cultural resonance. So they're doing this in the form of games. We're having there's jihad games now you can buy, you know, online where you can play and you can actually get in the mold of being an ISIS fighter and be one of these people. You know, engaging in that. So
actually, it's an entire industry, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an entire industry. I mean, they've got their own channel now. There's a channel for ISIS material. So all of this stuff, and because...
And they developed an app, didn't they?
Well,
Twitter.
Well, the thing is, the other aspect of this is that we're not just dealing with a a group of young people, we're not just dealing with a group of jihadis, we're also dealing with the fact that this is the former Ba'athist operation that are behind this as well. So now you've got a whole group of people that are actually, they have run a state, they have run a totalitarian state, and therefore they're adding to that the whole totalitarianism, the control, the discipline of the military, the discipline of actually how to function, and they're organizing state apparatus behind that. Their finances, not just the oil, but actually the taxation. They're running it as a state.
Okay, well, let's just get back to what's going on in the minds of these kids. So with your brother, for instance, your stepbrother, for instance, was he recruited online? Is that how they access to him?
No. He was. I think he was recruited at a carpentry workshop, so old school. But I think... I think with...
And what was that process? What do you know about it?
I don't know a great deal about it, other than the fact that I think, you know, he was primed and ready to kind of go, and someone came along, and Anjum Chowdhury came along and pushed, you know, the right buttons. Of course, Richard was... all of this kind of happened before ISIS and, you know, this kind of... you know, the kind of digital revolution, if you like. I think now, I think one of actually just one of the things I wanted to say was, you know, it's not just, you know, ISIS are great at the digital stuff because they're essentially just communicating with their own generation, like as Majid was saying. But I think there's a responsibility also of the media, you know, when it comes to sort of combating, you know, the ISIS's kind of recruitment drive. And often you see sections of the media in this country essentially just feeding the propaganda machine of ISIS. You know, certain sections of the media will... well, I mean, you think of the Jihadi John. You know, Mohammed Anwazi, this guy who's, you know, beheading people, and he's, you know, he's kind of quite affectionately called Jihadi John. He sounds like, you know, some sort of eccentric farmer or something from, do you know what I mean? You're kind of creating, you're creating a sort of pantomime. And, you know, I think the media needs to... Not all of the media, but sections of the media need to be more responsible. You know, they should, of course, be reporting what's happening. But I do think that, you know, the whole narrative which feeds this kind of radicalization in young people is facilitated by the media itself quite often. You know, terrorism needs fear in order for it to work. You know, if it's not creating fear, then it's failing, I think. And the media creates this kind of moral panic. It creates the fear. It makes it this big thing that kids, young people, you know, they see.
But they don't need to look at mainstream media anymore, do they? They've got their own online world where they can access that version of events. What did you want to say, Rashad?
I was going to say, actually, I kind of agree. I think there's two sides to this. You have the kind of very simplistic right-wing media, or parts of it, that would like to just very, very, you know, caricature Muslims and Islam in a very simplistic way. And then you have exactly the same portrayal by parts of the left-wing media, who would also equally caricature Islam and Muslims, but they have an understanding of it. So for the right-wing, you know, the Muslims are barbarians, and for the left, they are barbarians, but we need to understand why. And the net result is you have this kind of very much, it's like, you know, the left-wing racism that applies, I think, that we almost expect them to behave in this way as opposed to having any critical engagement. So a lot of the time, I actually think that the damage that is done by the left media is often where we end up almost saying this is the normal type of behavior in the current political circumstances.
Just to add to that, I think it's important to understand that ISIS is the end result of decades and decades of a long line of Islamist propaganda that's been operating on the Muslim grassroots. Its final stage currently is ISIS, and it could move on to something even worse than that. But we mustn't become fixated with just ISIS and understanding or trying to understand why they're so bad if we have ignored for the decades some of that underlying ideological propagandizing that's been going on the grassroots. And it touches on Rashad's point, because if as society, if we're prepared to tolerate bigoted ideas among Muslim communities that are being circulated just because we think that's their culture, we mustn't interfere. That's what eventually, is there any surprise that eventually those ideas spill over and have unintended consequences? It's like, you know, if we were to, because I'm thinking actually of a very current example that animated me recently, is some chap in America wrote a satirical take in the New York Times about Muslims being expected to condemn terrorism. And he drew an analogy with biker gangs.
Mujahid.
Yeah, and he pretended, you know, that he's a moderate biker who is now forced to condemn all violent bikers. And he was satirizing the idea that Muslims must apologize. And I got animated because I said, well, actually, imagine how insensitive it would be if at the peak of the U.S. civil rights crisis, when in Selma, Martin Luther King, on live American television, made an appeal to everyone in society, including white people, to join them in protesting against discrimination in Selma. And if a white person had then at that time written a piece in a right-wing newspaper satirizing Martin Luther King's appeal and saying, I'm not responsible for this, why are you asking me to get involved? As if I have to apologize for racism? When actually all Martin Luther King was asking for was a bit of solidarity and togetherness. And it's everyone's responsibility when these scourges arrive, whether it's racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, or Islamist extremism, to expect everyone to stand together and challenge that. And that includes Muslim communities. But there's been
let's talk about Muslim communities. Yeah. At the grassroots level, what needs to happen? Let's start talking about answers now. What is the answer to this? Is it families that need to start being much more aware of what their kids are up to and providing a better sort of environment for them so they're not drawn to this kind of ideology? Is it about the community taking responsibility as a whole?
You know, I don't blame the community. I don't blame the media. Maybe they are partly to be blamed, but I really blame the Western foreign policies. I blame the Western intervention on the Muslim world, military intervention. Now, in the Middle East, we have five failed states. And if you look at these five failed states, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Afghanistan, you will find one thing in common. All these countries failed because of Western military intervention. So when you create a failed state, you create a vacuum. Who will fill this vacuum? It is a radical organization, it's Islamic organization. ISIS, for example, you know, it is the outcome of the American invasion and occupation of Iraq.
I beg to differ.
Yeah, I don't think.
Let's get some
other views. We'll come back to you again.
Well, I think it's important to if we're going to take a scientific approach.
This is a scientific approach.
Well, it's an anecdotal approach.
Do you deny there is American invasion of Iraq and hundreds of people were killed?
Do you deny
that they dissolved the Iraqi army and they left more than a million people?
Let him make his point.
Rot.
Let him make his point.
And those are the hardcore of ISIS. I will send you a copy of my book to read.
Okay. All right. Go on, Majid. Make your point.
I'm absolutely not denying it's a factor, which is why I started off in response to your question at the beginning, talking about my own racism that I experienced and the genocide in Bosnia. It's a factor. It's not a cause. And it's dangerous to say it's a cause, because the minute we say it's a cause, we need a scientific causal link. And the reason why I'm arguing it's not a scientific approach, rather it's an anecdotal approach, is because there are other countries where that have experienced grievances. There are other individuals like Nazir who experienced grievances when they were growing up. He became chief prosecutor. I became chief recruiter for Hizb ut-Tahrir. That's why it's not a scientific approach, because there was a genocide in Rwanda. Bangladesh is far more affected by poverty than Pakistan is. And Pakistan's foreign policy in Afghanistan is more troublesome to many Afghanis than America's. So we have to consider that though these are relevant points that I'm not saying they're irrelevant,
I'm saying that they are... You think the American occupation of Iraq is completely irrelevant?
No, but that's what I just said.
You didn't say that.
I just said...
No, you are implying that.
I explicitly said they are relevant factors. I mean, I'll repeat it. These are relevant factors you're raising, but they are not causal because they are what I call very quickly, I call them half-truths. What I mean by a half-truth is, and it's how I used to recruit people to Hizb ut-Tahrir, I would always talk about the Muslim grievances to rile up this type of sentiment. I would miss out, for example, like Saudi Arabia is currently, as we're speaking, just this month, was bombing Yemen. It's a Muslim country bombing another Muslim country. But we don't see all Muslims in Britain protesting that.
Okay.
I haven't seen any protests.
Okay, Majid. Nazir, can I just bring you in? The original question was about what can families
do? Yeah, good. I forgot the question.
What can families do and what can communities do? Well, if this is a form of grooming of the kind that you described as parallel to sex grooming, the sex gangs grooming, what's the answer?
Okay, one of the things that pretty much every group working with young people will tell you is young people don't have anybody to go to talk to. They don't want to be problem with the prevent strategy. Any top-down government strategy is seen as policing. It's seen as you're snitching on somebody, rather than working with communities, giving young people an opportunity when they are at risk, or when they know somebody else is at risk, or when parents know their child's at risk, being able to go somewhere. They say we want a hotline. We want somebody somewhere that listens to us. And that's the same thing around child sexual abuse. We've spent generations telling children you can't, be seen and not be heard. Now, are we surprised when we're hearing what they're telling us and the abuse they've been suffering for generations? So we've got the same approach that we have to take around young people. They need somebody that's not the police, somebody that's not the state, that listens to their concerns. But they have, they're absolutely right. Imagine's absolutely right, and you are too, that there are grievances around the world, and the media has a role to play too. You know, they were saying, there was a headline in a newspaper, Muslim's dog kills cat. Why was the owner's...
radicalized dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, they see that. They see that it feeds into the identity crisis thing we talked about earlier on, that, Muslims are always seen in a negative light. And that's why we need to turn that around, too. And that's just not just the media's responsibility, it's every responsibility, picking on the role models that we have in our community.
Including Muslims.
And, one of the things that's been quite extraordinary that I've noticed, and I'm sure you guys have too, that a lot of the teenagers or the young people have gone out to places like Syria. Their parents have gone after them. Their parents have gone after them to get them back. Not many of them have succeeded, but that's what they're doing.
Comment on what you said, actually, because we do a lot of work in the schools in East London where a lot of these young girls and young guys have been travelling from. And actually, a lot of the kind of referrals and people coming forward is actually communities coming forward. We've had people from mosques contact us and say, hold on a second, can you come and help us because we've got these kids who want to go. We have had parents come forward and say, I don't know what to do with my kids. I try and take the passports away and to stop them from travelling. So actually, there is that there. And there is a lot of happening within the schools. I mean, in one of the schools, the Bethnal Green Academy, that's come under a lot of stick because it is where three of the girls have gone from. Actually, they've been doing a heck of a lot of work before this happened and now since to be able to get young people to open up and speak. I just wanted to just put that in, actually. Sure. There are spaces.
But what's the answer?
Don't think the answer is only and solely within the Muslim communities. The reason I say that is a number of things. Firstly, they don't live in isolation. Yes, there are segregated communities, but actually they still live interacting in wider society. The biggest problem, in my opinion, the single most biggest problem actually is here. It's civil society. Civil society has decided that we're going to turn our back on standing up for the values and ideas that we see as important for a multicultural society. What do I mean by that? I mean, if you look at one of these, we have a situation where in civil society, people are not going to stand up if somebody is a hate preacher who preaches homosexuals should be killed, as an example, but we'll make excuses for them because they come from a Muslim or the Asian background.
Because they're brown.
Because they're brown. We have this lower expectation. We have our intellectuals who are no longer now, they will make, I was in a debate on a similar topic to this a few weeks ago, where somebody who was a lecturer at university, who's a professor, he made some remarkable statement that he saw no difference between living under liberal Britain and living under the rule of ISIS. He equated the two in Saudi Arabia. And it's like, it's just ridiculous. Yes, I'm not saying it's a utopia living here, but actually, under Saudi Arabia, where they executed a magician, a sorceress, a woman for being a magician, just think about that, and we're talking about ISIS. All of those factors, where we have an intelligentsia that doesn't want to, that's retreating from the debate. And that is one of the biggest issues. Civil society has abandoned this debate.
Okay.
And I think that's where the biggest, challenge really lies, that actually we as society need to come up stand up for actually a certain set of ideas and values, and then find, because there are many people, Muslim voices, who actually have their backs turned on. The liberal voices in the Muslim communities who have their backs turned on because they're seen as, well, hold on a second, you're blaming the Muslim community. No, we're not blaming anybody, but we are acknowledging there are real issues to be dealt with.
So what can families do?
I think, just building on Rashi's point, because I wholeheartedly agree. But it's related. So what families can do is, it's not just Muslim families that need to do something. And what families across society, in fact, civil society, everyone needs to do, is imagine that we were experiencing at the peak of a crisis to do with racism in Europe, or a peak of a crisis to do with anti-Semitism. Everyone in their respective role in society has a responsibility, not just families, but also families. There is a role for media, if we're going to carry through with that analogy of racism. There's a role for the way in which media report around issues of racism, the role that the police, you know, with the McPherson inquiry that coined the phrase institutional racism was found in the police forces, they changed the way they operated after that. A role for politicians, a role for teachers, who, if they see a pupil being racist in their class, will call them out. You know, they don't feel like, I can't get involved in that. A teacher will be proactive in trying to instruct the pupil that racism is bad, even if it's in a mathematics class that has nothing to do with that. So now, bringing that analogy home, and building on both your question and Rashad's statements, that Islamism is no different. It carries with it, Islamism, not the religion Islam, but Islamism, the politicization of that, the desire to impose it on others, carries with it a whole set of bigotries. And we've got to start feeling comfortable as families and as civil society in calling out those bigotries, wherever they occur from, even if they are from minority communities, because we have this desire to protect minorities from criticism because of what the far right's history has been in this country. But that desire, when misguided, abandons what I call the minorities within the minority communities. There are feminist Muslims, there are gay Muslims, there are ex-Muslims who choose to leave the religion. All of those groups, there are liberal Muslims, dissenting voices, they are all relatively abandoned because society has preferred the group identity of being Muslim and trying to protect that over the dissenting individuals from within those communities. So everyone has a responsibility, including the police. The teachers. We recently read a lot about the Trojan horse cases in Birmingham. With the police, we read a lot about, you know, basically wet profiling and all that. Everyone has a responsibility to behave responsibly. Parents, I include in that.
Now, okay, well, let's talk about
can I end on the parents thing? Just make very quickly. Quick. That one of the young girls that went over to join ISIS from Stepney that you referred to earlier, and the role of the parents is crucial because two of the families, their parents were behaving very responsibly. One of them kicked up a big stink and fuss and did what Cage, this kind of so-called civil society group, this kind of pro-jihadist, did as well, which is blame our security services, blame our police for not doing enough. And it's kind of lose-lose because on the one hand, we from Muslim backgrounds complain that the police are being too heavy-handed, but then when our children join extremist groups, we blame them for not monitoring them enough. Hmm. We can't have it both ways. And it turned out that same father was photographed and videoed taking his daughter with him to extremist rallies, standing next to the killer of Lee Rigby. And so, you know, rather than taking responsibility for his own actions and taking his daughter to protest where, you know, all sorts of flags were being burned.
Can I just say that wasn't at the demonstration he went to with his daughter wasn't an extremist rally.
But he's been to demonstrations, right? So you can imagine.
He went to a lot of demonstrations.
Yeah, next to Lee Rigby and all these guys.
He just wanted to get involved with things. It wasn't like he was an extremist.
Yeah.
He just went to demonstrations because he cared about the plight of the...
Yes, but this is what I'm saying is that that awareness that you bring to attend those sorts of protests, we've got to start as society becoming a bit more aware that we're going to get hoodwinked in these ways. And if you're at these protests, you know, and you're going in naive in that way, then of course that level of naivety is going to be reflected in the way we raise our children as well.
Okay.
We've got to start getting, we wouldn't attend protests with far-right extremists.
Okay. So how do you educate the parents?
Hang on. Let me just ask a question around that. Nazir, if you had five kids that you had to... four teenagers?
Yeah.
Okay, so what action do you take to ensure that they don't end up being radicalized?
You talk to them. I mean, no child talks to me, but my own children do, actually. And... as you said a moment ago, they play their Call of Duties. They shouldn't. They're 18 certificate games. But, you know, we talk. And they talk to me, and they educate me. And going on to Majid's point about racism, you know, when I said something that I shouldn't have said, they took me to task.
because they've grown up in whatever schools they go to. They don't go to private schools, they're state schools. You know, they're told all the time, you know, call them up. If somebody is being homophobic, call them up. And that having that conversation and being able to share their concerns with each other, I think that, you know, going back to the point about communication.
And in Rob's, your stepbrother's experience, he didn't have access to his father, had very limited access to his father, and that meant that had an impact on what happened to him in the end. So communication is essential between parent and child.
Well, I mean, you know, as you need to, growing up as a person, you need to be, you know, as stable as possible, and you need to have a, you know, you need to grow up with a family unit and to, you know, to have all those human things that you need, you know, to develop as a person. And I think if some of those things are missing, then you can become vulnerable.
Okay. What are your top five counterterrorism tactics that are sort of hands-on grassroots tactics that you suggest parents, families, communities implement?
Being put on the spot. I think there's a few things, but if we understand, going back to the psychology of these individuals, one of the problems is that, well, something we don't like to talk about is the kind of fideistic psychology that actually removes their natural moral compass. Humans, kids, people have a natural moral compass. We tend to incline towards knowing what is right and wrong. If you shift that and you shape that and you change that and you tell people there is no such thing as right and wrong, there is no such thing as good and bad, your moral framework doesn't really count for anything. There's only the law of God. And the law of God is what I'm going to tell you. And whatever I tell you is the law of God, that's what is right. And whatever I tell you is wrong, that is what is wrong. And you can see, I'm not sure if you kind of experienced that with, you know, with Richard, that actually his whole mindset shifted.
Yeah.
That you couldn't almost relate to him.
But what's important as well is that, you know, these guys, you know, they have to believe in themselves that what they're doing is right.
Yeah.
You know, they have to actually believe that, you know, it's
so they
good.
Don't, so they don't see themselves as being on the wrong side of history. They don't see themselves as going and doing evil.
Yeah.
They see themselves as doing God's work. So that psychology then means that actually fundamentally you have to challenge that as a very basic idea that actually, no, there is such a thing as universal morality. There is such a thing that no matter what
you're talking about quite a big ideological discussion with young people.
I'm talking.
But answer my question. What are the things you can do on the ground or on a grassroots level?
To give an example, one of the kids that I worked with in North London, actually, one of the discussions we had was this: was hold on a second, how do you know anything? Epistemologically, it sounds like an epistemological discussion, very philosophical, but actually we had this whole discussion. How do you know anything? And so the next thought was, he was talking about critically thinking.
I want you to give me one, Rishabh. So you work on the ground with young people,
right.
So give me a really good...
It's a very simple concept.
So, okay, so you have big existential conversations with them. Is that what you're doing?
I think
as a point, we shouldn't patronise young people. They can actually.
Okay, that's great.
It's a very simple thing. We talk about this all the time. We call it critical thinking.
Okay, you've got and that. Okay, I'm going to have to move on. Thank you for that point. Go on the ground.
Mentoring is crucial. A lot of the dislocation that is felt from society in the sense of not belonging and not fitting in, whether it's for convicted terrorists in prison or it's those on the path to radicalization, if the state on the grassroots could facilitate a process that isn't connected to the police, that isn't connected to any form of official, you know, representative of the government or the state, but actually supports those like Rash and others, because actually he may be having these very complicated conversations with them, but they probably feel like a friend that is giving them the attention. And what could be more important than, though his conversations are very important.
Well, actually, you can break it down. It doesn't have to be as complex as
absolutely.
A epistemological
absolutely.
Debate.
It's too late now.
But what could be more important is even just the emotional connection that somebody cares.
I think mentoring is great.
I wrote something for BBC Online last Friday where I talked about women's groups, Muslim women's groups particularly, because they already have access to families if they're dealing with all manner of issues. And they're telling me that they can identify people at risk or potentially at risk. They then become Auntie G or the equivalent, and they're able to have a conversation with the children, which is outside of the family, but they're trusted. And it's, you know, whether it's mentors or whoever it is, it's finding those people in the grassroots that can be trusted, that aren't funded or seen as being part of the government or the state. And to my mind, that's having an impact. And we don't use women as much as we should do.
Thank you for saying that. Okay, should we get some questions from the audience? Yes.
There seems to be quite a cuddly, positive atmosphere about what civil society and families should do with these psychological ideas. What should a responsible British government specifically do?
Who wants to take that?
I can if you want. We do a lot of advice on some of these issues. I think foreign policy grievances, just to put it there, will always exist, and they will exist until the end of time. No 100% of society will agree with 100% of the government's policy, actually at home or abroad. But there are certain proactive measures governments can take. I mean, it would help if we didn't start illegally invading countries again. But on the domestic front, it's important that government doesn't seek out... Have you seen that BBC sitcom, Citizen Khan? You know, the community leader... Right. So I believe it's important that when engaging with communities, building on Rash's point earlier, that government sees Muslim communities as equal citizens and doesn't come at that kind with a patronizing approach, as one would, to give an analogy, Christopher Columbus lands in the new continent of America, finds the Native Americans and says, "Hail, bring me your leader." This kind of old approach that we had adopted, and I say that because it was official government policy throughout the 90s, has exacerbated some of these problems of communities being self-segregated, is that we come at the communities with the expectation that they are separate and then seek out a leader who can act as an interlocutor on their behalf. But rather, government should be seeking out individual and diverse voices within communities, feminist Muslims, females, gay Muslims, and empowering all of these voices rather than just going to the mosque leader. And I'll conclude by saying that, for example, if you're trying to deal with, as government and civil servant, you're trying to deal with racism in Essex, where I'm from, and where there's, you know, always historically been a bit of that, and you're looking to try and deal with some of the local skinhead lads, you're not going to, as a member of the communities and local government department, a civil servant, the last thing you're going to do is go to the church, find the priest, and say to him, "Can you advise me on how to deal with these local skinheads in your area?" Because, you know, these guys aren't, you know, they're not, and it's that patronizing to kind of constantly go to the Muslim, you know, community leader or the mosque imam and think that that's the gatekeeper and that unlocks the kind of the community, when actually the vast majority of Muslims aren't devout, and I count myself as one of them.
There's some practical things that could be done. Like,
Rashad, can I let Nazir come in and then you pick up straight off?
You're welcome.
Let's not scrap the human rights law.
It's downright laziness. I mean, obviously I worked for government or worked for the state for 25 years, and I can tell you that we had a list of Muslim organizations that you would liaise with, and they were the usual suspects. And, you know, we don't have white community leaders. You know, you don't have them, but we were automatically directed in a certain way. Well, we were told to. I never listened. But the point is, that's what we were expected to do. And we didn't go to the organizations or to people who at the grassroots who were really making an impact or working. You went to the ones which would tick a box.
Mm-hmm. And what about the government's unofficial non-engagement policy?
It is
now the, you know. But how does that, you know, how does that impact? How do you engage with a community if you refuse to talk to them?
Yeah, these things have to be tiered. Sorry, did you want to say something?
You know what I noticed, through this panel and this discussion, we, as a Muslim community, we are in the defensive side. We have to blame for everything. We have to police our children, we have to spy on them, we have to forget all the grievances, we have to be good boys, we have actually, you know, to praise the government, to praise the organization, as if we are the criminals here. I'll give one example. In the beginning of the Syrian crisis, this government, the government of Britain, which is my government also, you know, they were the only voice in the European Union, in Brussels, to actually advocate for arming the Syrian rebels, and they were encouraging indirectly the British Muslims to go and fight against this brutal regime in Syria. After that, now, if you go to Turkey, or if you go to Jordan, for example, you will find MI6, MI5 looking at your passport saying, why you are going to Turkey. So we have also to blame the government policies. Why they, for example, push the Muslim young people, to go and join the jihadis simply because they want to topple the Syrian regime. And after that, when about 1,000 of them went there, they are criminals and they stripped of their citizenship and they are arrested in the airport and tried and charged and all these kind of things. So we have to be fair to the Muslim community also. We shouldn't actually flog them all the time. You should do this, you should do that, you should... This is unfair, honestly.
Just a few things.
By the way, I'm secular. And you know, so it's. I'm not saying that, but you know, we have to be fair. We have to be fair to our community,
And I agree.
And we have to say the truth. We have not to blame the Muslims and the Muslim young people all
fair,
the time.
Which means very simple
things. And actually, that viewpoint is very widely held amongst many within the Muslim community,
particularly among the community leaders.
Yeah. So now, however, there's certain
this
things.
This is the wrong approach you are doing. You are turning the community, you know, against the government by always singling them out as should be blamed.
But Abdul, let's just hear him.
I'm not sure I said that, but okay.
You are implying that.
Go on, make your point.
So now, just a few things. The idea that we should sit back, I mean, I find horrific and horrendous, and it's not the topic of our conversation, but I find it horrendous to be living in a situation where the Assad regime has basically been responsible for almost 1 million deaths and displacing 15 million people, and we as a community, as a world community, have done absolutely nothing about it. I find that personally horrendous and amoral. But coming back, the government has never, or any government policy, implicitly or explicitly, actually encouraged people to go. In fact, for the last 3 years, we've been working quite close to different organizations within the communities and within government bodies to try and dissuade people from leaving to Syria. I mean, that's just, I don't know how to put it, they're just facts. In terms of looking at why, you know, rolling back again a little bit in terms of, you know, just being able to understand when you have a situation like Syria, why is it appealing to people to go? Of course, it's natural for anybody to see that situation and think we have an affinity to it, we want to go to it. And many of the young individuals that did initially go, if you speak to them, you'll find they went because they wanted to fight against Assad's regime. So many of the initial groups of people that went over, they went with very noble motives. And I think they are noble motives, and we shouldn't criticize them for that. However, the ones that have been going now since the establishment of ISIS, since seeing the brutality of ISIS, they are going because for the last 20 years in the UK, groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir, who have been going on talking about the need for an Islamic State which implements the Sharia, which doesn't recognize the borders, which will stone people to death, which will establish one caliphate to take over the entirety of the Muslim world, exactly as ISIS are doing, have been spreading that propaganda for the last 20 years. The Salafi jihadi speakers have been coming into the UK, spreading that propaganda, stuff that maybe you and I wrote, quite literally stuff that you and I wrote.
It's yours and Majid's fault.
So now, more his. So now, in terms of that, this has been happening. We have mosques and institutions which have been hosting preachers, like Muhammad al-Arifi, who came to the UK to tell people to go and fight jihad in Syria.
Okay,
so now, as a practical thing, what we should do is the government.
There's quite a few questions. Okay.
Just to come back to the point about what to do for the government.
No, we're going
to
move on, because we've only got 15 minutes, and but these four people want to ask. So should we start over here first?
It's only 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Hi, I'm Phil McCauley from the Movement for Change. I was just wondering, you know, it just seems as though we're sitting here almost ignoring completely the utter failure in British political context in the last several years in this. And I was wondering what you think the new government's message should be, or action should be, or policies should be in relation to this, because it seems to me that there's a complete abdication of responsibility across the board, internationally and globally, for this. There's no peace process.
You mean domestically,
thank you.
Or foreign? What is it? Policy here, at home, or abroad?
I mean, no.
Okay. Can we just get another question over here? Pick up another two. Yes.
Hello, my name's Aisha Usmani. You've talked a lot about what might attract young people to go to Syria, etc. But you haven't explained why those people are willing to lose their lives and be killed in that situation. And I would totally accept that there's grooming and all that going on, but I do accept that there is a wider context, which is touched on by Abdul Bari, which is about young people grow up realizing that life is not as they have been told. They understand the contradictions in life, but they can't work those contradictions out. And so sometimes maybe it's the groomers are giving them an opportunity for a quick fix. Look, the world will be fine if only we can do X, Y, Z, simplifying the contradictions in life. So talking to children, talking to young people, they, like, as you said, not only the ones who've got great A-levels, all the young people I've spoken to working in secondary schools have got the capacity to understand life's not simple, but they need to understand that, doing something, a quick fix is not possible either.
And can we get one, I think there were two more questions. So can I just pick both of those up and then we'll just go through them quickly?
Because you want to go to this side.
This one here and then we'll go back over there.
Hi, I was actually kind of linked to your point. We touched really briefly earlier on the idea of having these ideological conversations and critical thinking. And I just think that we've also spoken a lot about various different policy initiatives, people saying, what should we do? And it's become quite clear that things might work for some people, one individual perhaps, that might not work for thousands of others. So first of all, I was going to say that surely even the most perhaps incremental policy might be really important to pursue, even if it only helps a handful of people. And I wanted to touch on the point that you made earlier about these ideological conversations, because my feeling is that in our schools at the moment, critical thinking, ideological questioning and self-questioning isn't a huge part of the curriculum. We're told to digest facts, and unless you take maybe RE or philosophy A level, no one really comes along and says, hey, what is truth? What do these things even mean? And what do you believe, and why do you believe them? So I would say, particularly in the context of discussing role models and how important teachers are in that process, do you think we need to transform our education system, and can that have a role in this?
Thank you. And we'll just get one more question.
I would just agree a little bit with that last comment. This narrow focus on attainment over broad moral values is a big issue. We do peer-led education in Slough, trying to prevent people forming extremist ideologies. One of the things that strikes me is that we've talked a little bit about grievance. We've talked about hot jihadi fighters being motivating factors. But where we're from in Slough, we've just had a man who's 31, just a couple of years older than me, take his entire family over to Syria. And he was stopped on the border, and they've been returned back to Slough. But the point I'm trying to make is that we keep focusing on young people, but actually there's grown men that are willing to put their whole families in danger. I think what we've come to understand is that we need to have the debate, we need to have the argument, the critical thinking skills. But at the moment, for people like myself, there's just not a deep understanding of the actual narrative that says this is a good idea to take my entire family to Syria.
Okay.
So we can't challenge that.
Okay. So we'll take those four questions and one of you will answer one at a time. Abdul Bari, do you want to answer the question about what the government's new message should be?
Well, actually, I believe British government, by taking the American government side all the time under the banner of special relationship, I believe it's endangering the security of its own people. And this kind of, shifting or changing the policies, for example, at the beginning they want to topple Bashar al-Assad of Syria, for example, because he's brutal and financing and supporting and training the rebels. And other time, they said, no, our priority is not actually to topple Bashar al-Assad. Islamic State, IS, is very dangerous organization. We have actually to give it a priority and root it out completely from the region. So this kind of actually policies, it doesn't help. It doesn't help the harmony of the Muslim community here. It is, you cannot say to the people, okay, I want to take my family, for example, to Syria. Why should you prevent me from taking them? If I'm convinced that, okay, the Muslim community here, well, there will be less one family. What's good for UK, for example? what's the problem here? If three girls would like to go and marry those jihadists in Syria, let them go. This is their choice, for example. So, sometimes, honestly, we put ourselves in a place of judging people, and this is right and this is wrong. Who are we to say this is right and this is wrong? We're talking about freedom of expression, we're talking about freedom of choice, we're talking about liberalism.
We're talking about children.
There are other people, adult people. This is the people choice. But the government, honestly, the government, leave Middle East alone. Honestly, the British government should leave Middle East alone. Why should they go and intervene in Syria? Why should they go and interfere in Iraq? Okay. Why should they go and interfere in Yemen? Stay away, behave like Sweden, for example, or Switzerland or something like that.
I know you're probably all bursting to respond to that, but I'm going to ask you to respond to the next question. What should schools do?
We are so much of teachers. I don't know, any teachers in the room? I want you to deliver violence against women and girls training. I want you to deliver child sexual abuse training. I want you to... We're asking so much of you. And yes, it's a safe environment where children should be able to disclose and should be able to learn about human rights and everything else. I don't think that we can ask any more other than maybe we can help them in terms of the narrative. What you mentioned earlier on about, you know, what do you say to them? When I spoke to some head teachers in the end of March, I think, they said, I don't know what to say to them. They said they're being approached by parents on pretty much on a regular basis, concerned about their children. I don't really know what to say to them. I might send them down the channel route, you know, the channel program, or I might simply direct them in some, but I have no idea. And this is what head teachers were saying to me. So I think that we can do a great deal more about equipping teachers and head teachers about where to signpost. I don't think we should be expecting them to replace everybody else.
But do we need to have those big existential conversations that Rashad would like us to have?
No. I mean, I struggle with existential conversations on a regular basis anyway. And, I think we can have to simplify it. I mean, yes, children you know more than we do, and I totally accept all of that, but I think that we can simplify it. We can't say it's not about good and bad. I made the analogy about drug addiction. You know, if you tell somebody who's addicted to drugs that it's bad, it's not going to stop them being addicted. Mm. But perhaps some people who've been on the dark side, you know, and getting them involved in talking to young people and explaining to them the kinds of journeys they've been on, that might help.
Mm. Majid, why are people willing to lose their lives?
Mm. In his defense, he's very good at that, by the way.
He is. We're not undermining that.
When he has these one-on-one conversations, no, there is a role for that. I just want to defend Rashad there. There is a role to have, when you have de-radicalization, it's different to prevent. Yeah. So when you're trying to take someone out of these groups, you do have to have those kind of conversations because it's all in their head.
Yeah.
You know, they're using God to justify all sorts of things. Why is someone prepared to lose their lives? I was prepared to lose my life at one stage in prison in Egypt after I witnessed the torture of Hosni Mubarak. And I think that there is a combination of a whole host of factors that come into play for why somebody would want to give their life for a cause. But then the combination of those factors cannot be, and I can't emphasize this enough, extrapolated and applied to everyone on an aggregate level. We've got to get away from this idea that it's all about foreign policy, or it's all about ideology, or it's all about charismatic recruiters, or it's all about identity crisis. These things interact with each other. Human beings aren't like water. We don't all freeze at 0 degrees Celsius, and we don't all boil at 100. We react to things in different ways, which is why, you know, this man reacted to racism in a positive way. I reacted to it in a negative way, and I'm trying to make up for that with everything I'm doing now as somebody who's challenging extremism on a daily basis. So people react to things in different ways. Why I was prepared to give my life for a cause that I cared about was the combination of despair after having witnessed people drop dead in front of me from the torture of Hosni Mubarak in the very jail cells that created, that turned Muslim Brotherhood activists into jihadists, people like Sayyid Qutb, who were tortured systematically. I witnessed all of that combined with my self-justification, the ideas I was carrying. I was able to use those ideas to justify ex post facto an emotion I was feeling.
But those young people who are, you know, sitting at home watching videos, is that having the same impact then? Because they're obviously not watching.
And it's not just the videos. They are coming. That's why it's so important to understand that they're not just getting radicalized online or via these videos. They're coming from a milieu or an atmosphere that has been existent in our communities for decades, because prior to ISIS, there was Al-Qaeda. Prior to Al-Qaeda, there was Jihad al-Islami and other such jihadi groups. Prior to them was Hizb ut-Tahrir, and prior to them was the Muslim Brotherhood. For decades, this idea that the government, the type of organizational society one should aspire to is a theocracy, has been brewing on the grassroots, has been propagated for decades and decades. Many of these children now are being born into an atmosphere within certain communities where it's normal to glorify the resurrection of the caliphate. It's absolutely a normal aspiration. The conversation among them isn't whether a caliphate is a good idea, but it's how to establish a caliphate. That's the conversation, not is it a good idea to
establish.
Minutes left. I just need to get the other questions, and you can bring your point in later on if you like. Why are grown men prepared to put their entire families at risk?
I think it's the thing we haven't spoken about today is fundamentally if you have a set of convictions and beliefs. Your set of convictions and beliefs could be like the Red Army Fraction, and you fundamentally buy into that ideology and you see that as the greater good. And through the greater good, you can justify absolutely everything. And we saw that whether it was Mao, we saw that whether it was Stalin, and we see that now, because it's the greater good that your religion in this case defines beheading these individuals is the greater good. You know, getting rid of, you know, in Palmyra, it's the greater good to get rid of all the idols. It's the same thing. It's just a form of a virulent form of religious ideology. Just to give one example of that, of to understand the mindset again, one of the kids that came back when he was interviewed as to why he left ISIS, he said he was perfectly fine when they were stoning adulterers to death. He said, you know what, you might not like that. But he thought that was perfectly fine. It was when they started killing Muslim prisoners that he drew the line. And then he decided to leave and came back. Now, what that shows you is how how much the mindset is fundamentally shifted. And the only thing I would say as an alternative to that is, why is the critical thinking, why is the philosophy important? Because it's the critical thinking that stops you buying into this. And why is the philosophy important? Because we're going through now what John Stuart Mill said we would go through. He said, when you stop questioning yourself as to why you believe in liberty, why you believe in free speech, why you believe in free expression, you embrace it as dogma. And when you embrace it as dogma, you forget why it's important. And we're seeing that with people who are questioning, as an example, blaming the people in the magazine Charlie Hebdo for the killings of their people.
Okay.
And that's why it's important.
We have thinking, time philosophy for one more question.
Hey, you're talking about detachment from society. One of the main causes, or at least something that can contribute to detachment, is faith schools. What I want to know is, are faith schools necessarily a bad thing, or are they inherently cause detachment and we should just get rid of them?
Does anyone want to answer that one? Take that one on faith schools?
I'm a known Lib Dem. And Tim Farron, who's standing for the new leadership position, has made a pronouncement on that recently that the Secular Society reported on. And I think I take the view, I take the view there's an ideal and a pragmatic approach to it. Ideally, everyone would be mixed and integrated and what have you, but pragmatically, faith schools exist, and I don't think the way is just to kind of shut them down. I think the way that the policy is approaching at the moment is to try and encourage a certain proportion of people that are joining those schools from different faith backgrounds, and that they're talking to each other across different schools and trying to create those networks. It's very important. It's possible in 2015, today in London, to be born and raised as a Muslim male, not have a single non-Muslim friend, and not have a single female friend. I know, because my estranged son is one of those people who's been raised in that atmosphere. And that, for me, tells me there's a huge problem. And we've got to start looking at how to start getting these communities mixing better.
Okay. One more question. Should we take yours? Yeah. Rob, see if you can answer this one. Take it if you can.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm always quite concerned that when we talk about men radicalizing, it's multifaceted, identity crisis, thrill-seeking, et cetera, et cetera. But when we talk about women, it's always almost like they're sexually driven, hungry, they want to go for the bride, they're fantasized by this poster boy and so on. And I feel that's dangerous, because if we were to do something about it, that's the only lens we'll be looking at it from. And I feel like that's nothing new. We've seen that from the past, from analysis of terrorism, and now we're seeing it again. And I think we should be aware of that.
Okay. Not a question, though.
It is not a question. No, but why has it been legitimized as so? Am I wrong?
Rob, do you want to take that?
I don't think it is the case that it is purely to do with that. I think it may be a sexy way of talking about it in the media. But actually, I mean, they also buy into this utopian vision. I tried to explain they also believe they have a religious duty to go and migrate. They buy into the religious dimension. They also have this aspiration. They also detach. So I don't think that's how we've discussed it. If it comes across that way, my apologies.
But again, the media always seems to be coming out that way?
Possibly,
because it's like characterized, yeah.
I mean, that's Tazine's fault. she's the journalist.
Am I the only one? You're also a journalist.
That's true.
It's a really good point.
What shall I say?
Because you said it. You said it.
What did I say?
You said what you're saying. You said it was that they all there's lots of.
They want to get married to.
To be fair, Matt, you did it. He did it. He said that it's very good.
If there is a killer, is he entitled to marry or not? If there is a killer, a British white blue eyes killer, if somebody would like to marry him, you will say, no, don't go and marry him because he's a criminal?
If he's in prison, maybe. It depends upon the authorities. That's
even in prison, they allow them to marry in prison. And I know a lot of cases like that.
Not necessarily. What
amazed me, what amazed me in this panel, you're saying Muslim gay, should go and talk to the people.
Muslim lesbian should go and talk to the schools and the... Unbelievable. What's the difference between Muslim gay and other gays? Why we don't have Chinese gays or Malaysian gays or black gays? Or why always there is Muslim gays and the Muslim lesbian? This is the root of the problem in this country. The Muslims always singled out. If they go to marry, you know, simply frustrated girls, they would like to go and marry those. And by the way, they are young in their 18s and 20s, and they are very attractive, whether I agree with them or not. If somebody, a Muslim girl, fascinated with them and would like to go and marry one of them, is it a crime to marry somebody like this? Is there a law in this country? Show me a law in this country.
I'm going to give you a few. There's a law in this country which says 15-year-old girls should not be exploited. There's a law in this country which says you do not endanger your children. We have laws in this country which say very, very clear things about promoting terrorism and joining terrorist groups. Yeah, we have laws in this country which say you can't go and join and train in a terrorist camp.
But
we have laws in this country which say you can't glorify terror. So all those laws stop us from doing these things. They are curves on liberties, but we give up those liberties by living in a society. That's, you know, kind of how we've grown up here.
But if she's 14 and pregnant, is all right?
Well, I really don't know how to...
I think we should arrange another discussion.
Yeah, another discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you to my amazing panel for a very colourful discussion. And thanks for your questions too.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.